Porter versus Texas Ironworks. We have allotted 20 minutes for petitioner, 20 minutes for respondent, and 5 minutes for petitioner's rebuttal.
May it please the court, Mr. Bob Spann will present the argument for the court.
I'm quite sure that every member of the court has in the past appeared before the Supreme Court, and no doubt about it that there's a feeling of augustness and privilege and honor in being here. I want at this time to introduce my clients who came up here voluntarily. They weren't requested to do so, but Thomas Schrader and his wife and Doris are going to stand for just a moment. They, of course, have been frustrated in the past, and they're hoping that they'll find some end to their travail. I often wonder how an argument that's going to be given in 20 minutes can contribute anything to a presentation of a case in which you've spent hours and hours over briefs and cases and so forth. And it's just hoped here that I may be able to contribute a little bit, but not very much more to what's already been said and what's already been cited. First of all, this case is one in which the facts are relatively simple. Mr. Schroeder was an employee some 40 years, and there was a lot of firing and discharge of people taking place in Texas Ironworks, whom he had worked for those many years, and he was concerned about whether or not he might be among those who were discharged. And so on three different occasions, he approached his superiors to see if his job was secure, because he wanted to build a retirement home on Lake Mathis, and the record will show that there's no dispute that he did this, and this record will show that although there may be some equivocation as to the exact words, that there was no doubt that he made those inquiries and he was assured that he should go ahead and do so, and he did do so. The record is quite clear that after he had built a home and had a housewarming party for all the employees, some 10 days later, he was told that they couldn't afford him anymore, and that he was going to be discharged, and was discharged in October of 1964, and he filed a suit within a year after that happened. His suit was general pleadings of breach of contract, misrepresentation, and detrimental reliance upon the acts of his employer, and it was first removed to federal court on the claim that it was a federal claim for age discrimination, which it wasn't. And then it was remanded to the trial court for all purposes, for its contract claims, its modification of the at-will doctrine that Texas recognizes, and the age discrimination. Motion for summary judgment was filed by Texas Ironworks and was granted by the trial court on both of those causes of action. And of course, that's what finally brings us here. Now, in presenting these matters to the courts below and to the Court of Appeals, I personally was somewhat amazed that there was not any attempt for them to try to deal specifically with the cases that had been cited and were being relied upon in reference to the question of whether or not the doctrine of at-will employment in Texas could be modified by old agreements or special agreements that might take place between the employer and the employee. And I have simply made a list here of these cases in the order in which they occurred, in which the courts of Texas have recognized and clearly recognized over and over again this principle. In 1928, the St. Louis Railway Company v. Booker. 1940, Mansell versus Texas Pacific Railway. 1947, Dallas Hotel versus Lackey. 1952, Hardison v. Baylor Corporation. 1962, Culkin versus Neiman Marcus. 1972, Cree versus Figueroa. 1985, Johnson versus Ford Motor Company. 1985, Molnar versus Ingalls. Apparently, there's a confusion, there has been a confusion in the courts of law, that the Sabine case clearly excluded all other exceptions because of the fact that it recited there. But the Sabine case hasn't anything to do with what we're talking about here.
Assuming that the employment at will doctrine can be modified by an oral agreement.
Yes, sir.
Does the statute of frauds apply to that agreement?
Those cases that I've cited, Your Honor, point out that it doesn't.
Does not apply at all?
Does not apply. And I think that the cases also say that the traditional forms of contract, the requirement of date, time, place, subject matter, and so forth, have not been followed by these cases that I've cited.
What about consideration?
Consideration that's been cited in the Supreme Court cases that are cited, and some of the others, it's reflected that the continued employment of the employee is consideration enough for such a contract.
But the rule of consideration, the requirement of consideration would apply, but is satisfied by the employee working another day.
The fact that he continues in employment has been held to be by the courts as considerations to support a contract.
Well, even if the statute of frauds did apply, would such a contract satisfy the statute of frauds?
Yes, it would have satisfied also. I don't know how to answer that because there are a number of cases under the statute of frauds that have held that if the contract could be performed within a year, it didn't come within the statute. And so does that kind of holding apply to, does the statute of frauds apply to that case? I'd say the statute of frauds applies to it, but it doesn't cut it off. It doesn't destroy it. That's the way
well,
I think I'd
have
to
respond.
Yes.
This kind of an indefinite contract has been held not to violate the statute of frauds.
This contract has been held by this court and by the courts of appeals in the past and by other courts of other states that if it's performable within a year and it's indeterminate as to the length of time, it's not destroyed by the statute of frauds. There's one principle that I didn't cite in this brief that occurred to me last night. And the statute of frauds was a statute that was enacted to prevent fraud and injustice. And it cannot be used and cannot be pleaded to cause injustice.
Do you have any authority for that?
Yes, sir. I'll send it to you. I have a case at the present time in which a petroleum engineer gave his private information to someone, and they're producing wells every day. and they cited the statute of frauds because it didn't properly describe the land and so forth. And I'm on an appeal on summary judgment, but it's clear that the statute of frauds that originally was enacted to prevent fraud and injustice, and it cannot be utilized to cause fraud and injustice.
To pick the hardest case, though, if the facts were that the employer promised to employ the employee for 3 years, and in the middle of the second year terminated him, you would say that would be actionable in spite of the statute of frauds?
No, sir, I don't make that statement because there the terms of the agreement are one that couldn't be performed within a year. The case is
I asked earlier if the statute of fraud does apply to an oral contract, and I thought your answer was no, but you would concede that it does apply to a contract that would be for...
You're right. If the oral contract was for a period of time that was going to extend past the 1 year, that oral contract wouldn't be enforceable because of the statute of frauds unless... invocation of the statute of frauds was going to cause injustice or wrong. And so the application of the statute of fraud is limited by those principles. And the same thing is true of estoppel. It's quite easy, when you reflect upon the history of estoppel, it came about because courts of law were too harsh. And so the equitable principles began to apply to step over these harsh principles that had become ingrained in the common law. And we're almost getting in that same position now. Now you see the defenses to my claim of estoppel here are these hard, rigid rules that they want to apply in order to prevent it from applying. And when estoppel in pious, which is just generally to prevent injustice and fraud, was never so restricted. And I have those citations in the Texas jurisprudence. They're also in the CJS estoppel in great quantity. Here we have a person in which the trial court was made to believe and the Court of Appeals was convinced that you had to meet these certain rigid standards in order to seek justice in the court. I'm presenting to this court that the original reasons for equity, the original reasons for estoppel, the original reasons for those principles is still with us today, and that we need to guard against overlooking what's right and what's wrong
under
by
your
curtailing
view,
with rigid requirements. Yes.
Under your view of the contract in this case, is, as you allege it to be, could Texas Iron Works ever have fired Mr. Schroeder?
I think that they could, but not for the reasons they fired him.
For what reasons?
They fired him because they couldn't afford him anymore, and that's what they told him. And he went to them to see if that was going to be a reason for it, and they told him, no, that your job is secure. He says, you know, y'all is cutting down and firing everybody, and I need to know whether or not this slump is going to get my job, too. And they said, no, don't you worry about it. Now, remember, this man's a 40-year employee. He had done everything from cleaning button-ups and bolts in a bucket in that company's work to rising to the superintendent of a production plant.
So if his work turned bad or he was caught with his hand in the tambourine, they could fire him?
Yeah, if they had a just cause, but the cause that he was worried about was not whether he performed his job properly. He knew he was going to do that, and he felt like he was whether or not the oil slump was going to cause it. And that was his concern. And you can see in the record that he didn't just take one assurance. He demanded it three times. The last time he says, I want to talk to the president himself, and his supervisor said, what do you want to talk to him for? Don't you believe what I tell you? He said, go ahead and build your house. And so he did. And of course now he's here.
If we assume that each response given to your client was based upon information available at the time, and realizing that the oil slump increased in geometric proportions, would it not be possible that conditions in the marketplace so changed that the previous answer would be incorrect?
Your Honor, my belief is that they couldn't discharge him because of that, because they had other employees. They didn't go out of business. They had other people that were junior to him. And he has probably as great a capacity to do the work they needed, and he asked for another job at lesser pay. So I think the injustice of that is imposed upon him is quite evident. That
so
they,
you would recognize an excuse doctrine if they went broke?
Yeah, I think if they went broke, there wouldn't be any way there.
That's a different lawsuit, isn't it?
I think it'd be entirely different questions involved. Yes, sir, but these... In other words, the cases I cited, in when you read those cases, you'll see that the agreement between the employer and the employee is based upon what the employee did, in some cases by a detrimental reliance, and also they construct this agreement out of the totality of it in order to arrive at a just result in this case. And that's what we've asked to be done in the court below. And this man's ability to perform various jobs, his loyalty, his reliability, his truthfulness, I think he's even evidenced by his responses in the depositions, that he thought that when they told him that they were telling the truth and they believed what they said. But as a matter of law, the application of law, a great injustice and a legal wrong has been done him.
Under your theory, would the company be stopped from terminating him as long as he had a mortgage on his retirement home?
I think very possibly so. They got him in that position. He had a home almost completely paid for. You know, in many years he sold and invested these funds. You have a negligence issue here too, you know. That's really not pleaded here, but there's stop on those others, but it is actually brought up in the response to the motion for summary judgment, I believe.
Did the company have any policy about forced retirement at a certain age?
I'm not aware of it. I think there was just an implication by the response to questions on deposition by Mr. Schroeder that he would expect to retire, I think, at 65, or whether that was a requirement.
And how old was he?
He's 57.
So he, in effect, took early retirement.
he was required to draw that money down in order to meet his obligations.
I mean, he was forced into early retirement.
Yes.
But the policy of the company was that they could work much longer than 56.
It should have been, Your Honor. That's not developed.
There's no evidence about the company policy at the age of retirement.
There wasn't any generation of any question on that issue.
What age was he when he was forced to retire?
57.
So he's older than that now.
Yes. And you'll see in the record, of course, that at the time of the motion, at the time of the deposition, the man had been seriously ill, about to die. He's alive now. You know, I think his kidney, something like that. But he's not an employable person right now. And, of course, when you look at the aspect of where he was at that time, he was 57 years old. He had a vested retirement. He didn't have the reason to believe that his job wasn't satisfactory to them. He could do other work for them and so forth. If he got sick, as he did actually get sick, he had a health insurance plan that was being maintained, and he had a early retirement plan that would have benefited him and so forth. He had to give all that up because of this. And why? Because he had built his house. If he hadn't built that house, this wouldn't have happened to him. There's another aspect here that time is running out on.
I don't understand. Why did building the house have anything to do with it?
Building the house put him under a financial strain that he was trying to avoid if he couldn't keep his job. In other words, he didn't want to build a house, and he had no obligation to build it if he wasn't going to be able to maintain his job, a job with the company. So when he went to them and asked them on three different occasions, is my job in jeopardy because of this recession in the oil business? I need to know, because I want to decide whether I should do this or not. And they told him on three different occasions, your job is secure. We take care of our managers. Go ahead and build your house. He did, and which created this financial burden. If you reverse it the other way and say, suppose they said, no, we can't say anything. Don't build your house. We don't know what's going to happen. He wouldn't build the house. He wouldn't be in the financial bind that he was in. He wouldn't have large payments on a new home. He wouldn't be forced to cash in his early retirement in order to survive and try to hold the home long enough to see what he could do to
get it. I know you wouldn't have brought the suit, but would there be a cause of action under the doctrine you'd have us enunciate? If he just went to his managers and said, out of idle curiosity, I'm concerned about my job, I don't have any other offers, I'm not planning on spending any other money, but I just want to know if my job is safe. And they said, we have every confidence in you, your job's safe, don't worry about it, go and do a good day's work. Would that create the same type of estoppel? Or does there have to be some out-of-pocket detrimental reliance on his part? Or is it, you said earlier, the consideration just working one more day for the company?
An excellent question. I think it's answered in the cases that have been cited, that where a person is assured that his job is secure and safe, and there's nothing more said than that, there's an implication he's not going to be fired except for good cause. And that, I think, is the very thing that we found in the very first case, 1928, in Booker. And we find it again in several of the cases cited here. The courts have said, well, once he's been assured that his job is safe here, he's not going to be looking for other employment. And so that's an implication that he's not going to be discharged except for sound cause, not just at the whim of it.
Mr. Spann, your time is about to expire. You've answered the question, or at least you've addressed a part of the Court of Appeals decision on statute of frauds, but you have not addressed the exhaustion of the administrative remedies.
I'll try and get to that.
Would you address that?
Yes, sir, I will, and very quickly. That it's simply this, that a practicing lawyer such as myself, or a reasonable person such as everybody, when you read that statute, that creates the age discrimination and the other grounds for discrimination of Texas. If you read it and have no other knowledge whatsoever, you would be led to believe that you didn't have to file a suit before the commissioner. But if you were to study it and read it in the background of the Federal Act, where you have specific provisions that tell you you don't have a civil cause of action unless you file with the commission, then you would be convinced that under the state statute you didn't have to file it. And I'll say this, we were convinced. And there are a lot of lawyers in this state I've had. Incidentally, this court can create friends by granting writs. I've gotten, I tried to get amicus curiae briefs filed on my behalf from all over the state and didn't get them. And when you granted the writ, suddenly I started getting amicus curiae briefs. But not all of them in my favor. But nevertheless, I don't see how anybody can discount the Worker Compensation Act, which requires you to do it.
You have additional time.
All right, sir. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
Court, James Lefler will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Jim Lefler, and I'm an individual practitioner in Houston. At no time has the petitioner claimed that he is trying to amend he's trying to change the law of Texas, either by having this court rule anything dealing with good faith or fair dealing, or trying to abolish the at-will doctrine. And at no time have we, the respondent, argued that an at-will employment relation can only be changed by a written agreement. We think the law of Texas is that normally you have an at-will employment that can be changed by an oral commitment, a contract with the employer, but if that contract is to be performed beyond 1 year, or it can't be performed within 1 year, it's covered by the statute of frauds. In this case, we have an individual. Oh, and I might also comment that I think some of the wording used by the Court of Appeals may have been a little bit unfortunate, but I don't believe that they were saying that you had to have a written agreement to change an oral an at-will employment. I think that the court was fully versed on the fact that the petitioner is using, or he claims that these three comments that counsel referred to guaranteed his employment until retirement, which continued for 8 or 10 more years. And that, I think, is what the Court of Appeals is talking about with reference to writing, needed to be in writing to avoid the statute of frauds.
I assume that you would also concede that if an employer promised an employee continued employment, knowing at the time of the promise that he didn't intend to keep it, and that the employee would rely on it to his detriment, that would be actionable as well.
That would be, yes, the doctrine of estoppel would come in there.
And is your position that that claim is not made in this case, or that it's was disproved by the summary judgment evidence?
Yes, Your Honor, the summary judgment evidence in this case is the petitioner's own sworn deposition, where we sat right next to his counsel and his wife, and he just claimed there was no misrepresentation. The company officials were in good faith. They didn't know any more about the depression in the oil industry than he did. They did not intend to deceive him. They did not intend to defraud him. And these things just happened. And they didn't intend to have him, force him to build a house, and they didn't rely on, they didn't gain anything by him building the house.
Now, did he have summary judgment proof, though, that contradicted that testimony?
No.
Is it admitted that the employer knew that he was going to build a house?
Yes.
And because he was going to build a house based upon their answer to his question?
Well, I don't know about that. If I may, I'll go into the facts, and you'll see that these statements were completely vague. First of all, the petitioner was hired in the company's Victoria plant. Was a long-term employee. In 1980, because of the depression, the oil field service business, the Victoria plant was closed down. Everybody was laid off but the petitioner. At age 54, he was transferred to Corpus Christi plant. In about 1982, he decides that he wants to build a house on Lake Mathis. He buys a piece of land up there. He has it graded. A water well is put in. He has a seawall put down. And he's got a pier put on there. Then he sells his home in Corpus Christi, and he moves into a cabin owned by a cousin on Lake Mathis. I mean, he's ready to go with this house. And as he's about to negotiate and sign his contract to build a house, he picks up the phone one day, and he calls his boss in Houston, and he's down at Corpus Christi, and he says, listen, are there going to be any more layoffs in Corpus Christi, because I'm about to build this house, and I don't want to build it if I'm going to be laid off. And the manager says, well, I don't know anything about you being laid off. Go build your house. About a week or 10 days later, and this takes place in November of 1983, about six days later, he calls up again in Houston, and this time he wants to talk to the president, Steve Pierce. And he claims that the same boss, his boss, picked up the phone and said, well, what do you want to talk to Steve about? And he said, well, I want to ask him, you know, I'm about to build this house, and I don't want to be laid off after I build this house. And the manager says, I've already talked to Steve. He said, go build your house. So about maybe a week later, still in late November, maybe early December of 1983, he sees Steve Pierce walking through the plant. And he said, hey, Steve, are we going to have any more layoffs here? And Steve says to him, I'm going to keep my managers. And based on those three statements, the petitioner says under oath and to this day that he had a contract which amended his admittedly at-will employment, which he admits that he had up to the point of these statements, for 6 or 8 years until his normal return.
How many employees will let go in Victoria?
These are small operations, Your Honor. I would say 20 at most. And so, all right, so the company, then the things get worse and worse. He admits in his deposition things got worse and worse, that the company officials that said these things to him didn't know any more about the condition of the oil industry than he did. And then they decide they're going to close the Corpus Christi plant. Everyone in the Corpus Christi plant is laid off but the petitioner. The petitioner, because of his long service, is assigned a job to shut the plant down. As soon as the plant is shut down, he, because of his long service, he's moved over to sales and service in the hope that maybe something will break, things will get better, or maybe the company can find a job for him someplace else in the company's operations. Things go downhill further and further. He doesn't know anything about sales or service, and they finally come to him in August. And he's finished with his home in June of 84. Company comes to him in August of 84 and tells him, regretfully, we're going to have to lay you off. But we're not going to lay you off until November of 84. So
I have two questions.
Yes, sir.
I think up to this point. One, does the recitation of the exchanges between Mr. Schroeder and his bosses, would that create a cause of action had there not been the Victoria plant, the Corpus plant closed? In other words, if he had just been fired but the plant had stayed open, would that be enough?
I don't believe so.
If not, then, where do we draw this line between these cases? I mean, how would we write a rule that says to an employee, you've now got a statement that's definite enough that you have an oral contract?
Well, I think first you have to have words that rise to the dignity of a contract. Secondly, you have to have some consideration. The fellow has to be...
But we've held in a lot of contexts, non-compete agreements, that just working one more day, just staying on the job is consideration.
Well, I think the rule in Texas is that staying on the job is not sufficient consideration. That the person has to give something. He has to give, if he were going to leave his employment, the company said, no, listen, we'll guarantee your job for so long. That's consideration. If he didn't want to do a certain job the company needed him to do, and the company said, well, listen, if you do that, we'll give you this, then that's consideration.
But in consideration, we're talking about legal consideration. Benefit flowing to the promisor of the company or detriment to the promisee. Wouldn't he be able to claim legal detriment because he has incurred a legal obligation in the form of the mortgage?
Well, but to have a contract, you have to have consideration. If you're talking about detrimental reliance is not a cause of action in and of itself. It doesn't create a new cause. It's merely one of the requirements for estoppel.
I'm saying that by incurring legal detriment, he has, in effect, there has been consideration.
Well, I don't think so, because there's a lot of people that take words for clearly what they don't mean and do something on it very inappropriately and then claim detriment.
But isn't the fair import of what he was told that he was going to be, that his employment was going to continue?
I think the fair import, what he was told, Your Honor, is simply that at that time they had no present intention to lay him off.
Well, that's not what he was asking.
Sure he was.
His question was directed to whether he should buy a retirement, or whether he should spend funds for a retirement home, not whether he was going to keep his job through the day.
Correct.
And when that question was answered, is there no obligation on the part of the employer? The employer didn't have to answer it. The employer could have said, we don't know.
Well, that's what they said. We don't know. Go build your house.
That's not what
and he had built his house and completed his house 4 months before he was told. And these statements were made about a year before he was finally laid off.
Where was the next nearest plant? The closed Victoria, the closed Corpus.
Probably Houston.
Did they offer to transfer him to Houston?
They offered to transfer him well before this all took place, and he didn't want to do it.
Why?
We think he wanted to retire in Corpus Christi on the lake.
But they had offered him a job in Houston?
Yes.
That's in the record?
Well, but not at this particular time, before this time. The only time this other job opening came up is two-sided. When he was told he was laid off, then he then asked, isn't there any other job for me? And they told him no.
What is the span of time between the conversation of go ahead and build your house and the assurance that he got by the time he took early retirement? How much time elapsed?
A year. Conversations? 1 year.
Let's talk a little about the statute, which is not easy reading to me, and is a case of first impression in the state, is it not?
I believe so, Your Honor. Well, it's clear from the legislative history, and I think one of the judges was a senator at the time, that the Texas House of Representatives and Senate desired to pass a statute, a non-discrimination statute, that covered the same areas that the federal statute covered, because they wanted to have their own Texas statute, and they didn't like the delays that were taking place under the federal EEOC. And there's just total pari material here as far as reliance on the federal language.
Except the federal language says you got to file first, doesn't it?
No, not in the Civil Rights Act. No, it does not. There's two statutes that are even mentioned in the Texas statute, and that's the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which is the same, basically the same. There's no statement in there that says you must file before.
And you don't in federal court, do you?
Well, you have to file a complaint.
Probably. The private citizen has to file an EEOC complaint.
Oh, yes, definitely. And that's been held by numerous Supreme Court circuit courts.
And that's not anywhere in the statute. That's case law that has developed.
Yes, yes. Now, 4 years later, when the federal Congress passed the Age Discrimination Employment Law, they put a provision in there that said you had to file first before you go, but statute
not in the
1964 Act. The section 101, as I remember, of the Texas Act says to provide the policy is to provide for the execution of the policies embodied in Title Roman numeral 7 of the Federal Civil Rights Act of 1964 as amended. Then it says, and to create an authority that complies and meets the criteria of the statute, which is the age discrimination. And so while the petitioner argues that, well, if they wanted to say, if the Texas legislature wanted to say that you must file with the administratively with the Texas Commission, they should have said so. But they were using the same basic language that was in Title Roman numeral 7 of the Civil Rights Act. Then the petitioner argues, but look at the ADEA says over here that you got to file. But the Texas Commission Act does not rely on the policies and the procedures of the ADEA. And it's clear in the legislative debate that all the senators and the congressmen fully understood that the federal law was going, as interpreted, was going to apply the same way to the state statute, and the state statute was not going to create any additional rights for employees or burdens on employers. So the only thing that the state statute picked up from the Age Discrimination Employment Act of 1967 was, one, they included age in the act, And in the federal scheme, there's two acts. And the Texas Congress put it all in one. And then secondly, that they had to abide by the ADA's funding requirements. I don't think that's even mentioned in the Civil Rights Act. And that's another reason why the Texas legislature had to model the Texas Act right after the federal act, because if they didn't, they weren't going to get the federal funding. The Texas people, we didn't have any money down here to fund this. All these charges in the administration and the conciliation. And it's also clear that the plaintiff himself, the charging party here, or the petitioner, is filing under the state statute, under no other statute. So he can't use the language in some other part of the state statute that says that, well, you can't sue under this act if you've done something someplace else, because this is the only place he's got to go. There's no Texas policy against AIDS discrimination, against sex discrimination, against handicap discrimination, or any one of those things. There was no common law before the passage of the Texas Human Rights Act. No policy against it whatsoever. The Texas Commission on Human Rights Act embodied all that and followed the Fed. They followed the Fed because they needed the money. That's what they wanted to do. They talked in legislative debates about how we're going to follow the federal statute. They talked clearly in terms of that we're not going to add anything or subtract any rights. The petitioner cites the Texas Lemon Law. Well, the Texas Lemon Law was passed in the same special session, but by different people in different committees. It originated in different house, and the people of this state already had a law that they could file. If they bought a lemon automobile, they could sue under the Texas Deceptive Trade Practices Act. The Texas Lemon Law was clearly meant to add additional rights and certainly not to take away our citizens' rights to file under the DPA. And so it's clear that's just an entirely different set of circumstances.
Are the only other states that have passed a fair employment law in order for federal funding those listed in the amicus employment council brief?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think almost every state in the union has got one now.
Got one, and this question, are the authorities split?
No,
whether or
no.
Not
it's my understanding, and I must confess to you that I have not read every case in the union, nor have I compared their statutes, but it's my impression that there are no cases, either federal or state, in other jurisdictions of the other 49 states that have held that the person can go immediately into the state court and file a lawsuit for any discrimination covered by their state employment act. And this is one of the arguments that I have, and it's my personal opinion, which is probably worth what you're paying for it, but that the fact of the matter is that if you hold that under the state act, our state act, that a person doesn't have to file a complaint, can go immediately into the state court, that it's probable that this is a direct irreconcilable conflict with federal law, because it would wipe out the policies of both statutes in the state of Texas. And this would not be like the state of Texas passing a law saying, well, we're going to decide that the wage hour law can be minimum wage is $4 an hour, and the federal statute is only $3.80. There's no conflict there. It's been clearly held numerous times that you can give more, but in this case, the alleged giving more would be a totally irreconcilable conflict, because then both statutes, all the administrative, all the investigatory, all the conciliation policies of both statutes would be totally thwarted, as would be the legislative intent that's clearly manifested in. There is a very, very good brief.
Counsel, I understand your argument in that regard. Do you cite authority for that proposition that there would be such a direct conflict?
No, I have no authority for that.
Just viewing the two, you view them as...
Yes, and that's my personal opinion, and I have no case law saying that, but I have not really researched it.
Let me change focus entirely to a procedural point. You were successful in getting special exceptions sustained against the petition by the trial court, and then, of course, the summary judgment. The summary judgment order reflects that it was not based upon a failure to read plea by the plaintiff. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. We tried to get the plaintiff to, among other things, to plead how much he was asking for, and he refused to do it, and to this day he still refused to do it.
Well, was the plaintiff Was all of this done at one time, the order on special exceptions and the granting?
I think it was done, the order on special exceptions was done 2 or 3 weeks before, as I remember. And then all this other, our motions for summary judgment came in later. And in our mind, had nothing to do with that.
Your exceptions, though, dealt with more than just the amount of money pledged. Did they go to his failure to take cause of action?
I'm not sure. I can't even remember, Your Honor.
I believe the order on special exceptions and part of the exceptions are in this record.
Yes, I think so. I think so. As is his complete deposition, which really should be read.
But you agree that with the case and the procedural posture that it's in, you are entitled to a summary judgment only if you disprove one element of each of the plaintiff's claims.
Right. And I think we've disproved 4 or 5 out of his detrimental reliance. I would invite your attention to amicus curiae brief that's been filed already just a few days ago. You probably haven't had enough chance to read, by the Hughes and Luce firm, and I think it's an excellent one, far better than our response to the petitioner's writ of error. Thank you very much, Your Honor. If there's any more questions, we're glad to answer.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I believe that in all practicality that the appellee in this case, or the respondent, has really conceded that the modification of that will doctrine is live and well in Texas. It just argues as to whether or not there's any fact issues. I don't feel there's any question of what there are fact issues raised in the courts below that should have prevented the entry of a motion for summary judgment.
Do you feel now that the pleadings in the case, the plaintiff's pleadings, ought to be amended or could be amended to improve the allegations that are being made here?
I could always improve, Your Honor.
But
and I would.
In order to avoid summary judgment, do you think repleading would avoid summary judgment?
I don't think repleading was involved. The pleading was involved in the summary judgment. The order of the court was granted not upon the failure to amend. Incidentally, those exceptions wanted us to do things that were concept of the defendant of a very, very strict contractual application of this thing, which is not what's been followed by the courts. The courts have constructed contracts out of the agreements, and they wanted us to name time, place, date, writing, and things of that nature. The exceptions are it's so that the plaintiff will be confined to certain claims, and so the defendant know what he's going to try. And there's not any issue here. And Your Honor, your question as to whether or not the summary judgment was based upon the failure to replead, I don't think it had anything to do with whether it was replead or not. Obviously, the final order of the court was written by Texas Ironworks Council in this case, but it's still, the motions for summary judgment were granted, first of all, on the basis that it couldn't be enforced because of the statute of frauds and lack of consideration, those kind of things. And also on the age claim because there wasn't any filing. the exceptions.
We're a little sensitive right now, perhaps, to the preemption doctrine, since we just had a certiorari granted on one of our opinions this week. How about these other states that have all done that there is an exhaustion requirement?
I don't know that that's true. That's just a general claim that's being made by some people. I don't know that it's true. And even if it is true, could the legislature adopt legislation that allowed you the choice to go directly into the courts or waste your time in some bureaucratic hearing?
Well, I guess that's my question.
I think they could. And I think they did.
But if they did, which one would you always choose?
I think it would depend on each situation. I think each one. But here's what, in the brief it's pointed out that the legislature had before it this provision in the Federal Act on Age Discrimination, 29 U.S.C. 626, third paragraph D. No civil action may be commenced by an individual under this section until 60 days after charge alleging unlawful discrimination has been filed with the Secretary, and the times in which it has to be done. Now, that was in the Federal Act at the time that our present State Age Discrimination Act was passed. Why did the legislature leave it out? You know, and I think the reason for the position of TCHRA, who, by the way, they're charged with trying to protect people like Schroeder. And they're in here trying to defeat his cause of action by an implied forfeiture of a right under the act. Why are they doing that? I see now it's because federal funding is somehow tied with whether or not you go to them first or not. And what, I mean, I think it's well recognized that an administrative agency is continuously trying to broaden its powers and increase what it does. And that also could explain why they're in here filing an amicus curiae brief, getting the Attorney General to do it to destroy the cause of action. What I appeal to this court about is this, that I didn't try to bring in all these other cases that have been filed, which the lawyers thought that they didn't have to file when they read the statute. Because those lawyers don't want anybody to know that that happened. They don't want it to be raised in their own cases. And so they're not in here filing an amicus curiae briefs, because they don't want to trigger a reaction on a defendant who will come in and rely upon the Schroeder case as it presently exists. But the truth is this, that if the reading of this statute, now first of all, if the legislature could write one and give you the choice, then did they do so? And our position is they did that. And if they didn't do it clearly, would it be just to...